Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Pope Benedict makes a pastoral visit to the northern Italian cities of Venice and Aquileia. Hear from our correspondent there and from the rector of the Research and Study Centre named after St. Mark the Evangelist. And a young leader for an ancient church. The new major archbishop of the Greek Catholic Church in Ukraine tells us about the challenges of reconciliation with the Orthodox world. Pope Benedict XVI on Saturday afternoon takes off from Ciampino Airport here in Rome for a visit to the northeastern Italian cities of Aquileia and Venice. His first stop is the ancient and influential Roman city of Aquileia, today quite a small town situated close to the head of the Adriatic Sea. After greeting local residents in the main square, the Pope is then due to address an important church congress in the imposing cathedral built over the site of an ancient Roman basilica. Vatican Radio's own Chris Altieri has been exploring the city ahead of the Pope's visit. He sent us this report on the church in northeastern Italy.
Strengthening the brethren, confirming the faith of the church, this is the key and the core of Pope Benedict XVI's visit to northeastern Italy. But what church is the Holy Father meeting this weekend? First of all, it is an ancient church with origins reaching back to the first century. Though Aquileia is now best described as a quaint and quiet town, it was once one of the wealthiest and most important cities in the world. Founded in 180 BC as a military outpost to protect Roman allies during the city's wars to bring an end to piracy in the Adriatic, secure the Italian peninsula, and expand Roman control into the Western Balkans, the colony of Aquileia grew rapidly and eventually became the third city of the empire, a center of commerce and a cultural crossroads for centuries. In fact, the earliest worship building on the site where currently stands the soaring, thousand-year-old structure of the Basilica of Aquileia was a house church from the time of the Emperor Augustus, a domus ecclesia, though it was no humble abode. Rather, it was a sprawling Roman villa belonging to a wealthy and important family in one of the wealthiest and most important imperial cities. Patient and painstaking archaeological work has preserved and continues to preserve the precious artistic treasures found there, treasures that are not only part and parcel of the contribution Christianity has made to the common cultural patrimony of Western civilization, but also physical testaments to the Christians who pledged their all, their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to practice and to spread the faith throughout the whole world.
È la Chiesa Madre, la Chiesa che ha dato la fede a tutto l'Est, che ancora oggi ne è riconoscente.
As the archpriest of the Basilica and pastor of the Basilica Parish, Monsignor Michele Centomo, explained during my visit to the Basilica ahead of the Holy Father's arrival, the Church of Aquileia is mother to more than a dozen churches stretching throughout the northeastern part of present-day Italy and into Slovenia, Austria, and Croatia. The church that the Holy Father is meeting here is therefore culturally rich and diverse. This is not any lab exercise in multicultural theory. Here, the human capacity to bridge divides, find common ground, and construct a social order that is at once respectful of cultural identity and ordered to the common good is a practical necessity. The Holy Father's remarks will serve as a guide to the organizers of the upcoming Second Ecclesial Assembly of the Northeast, which in April of 2012 will meet to discuss the most pressing questions facing them singly and as a family dedicated to evangelization. And an integral part of evangelization, old and new, is the task of finding ways to allow the gospel to penetrate and transform culture. Beginning with the homily he delivered at the Mass inaugurating his pontificate, in which he recalled the appeal of his predecessor, Blessed John Paul II, to open wide the doors to Christ, and encourage the present generation to embrace that invitation, saying, "If we let Christ into our lives, we lose nothing, nothing, absolutely nothing of what makes life free, beautiful, and great. And again, in dozens of speeches, homilies, and letters to the whole Church, Pope Benedict has articulated his profound conviction that the Church, that Christian faith, and therefore the Christian faithful, must speak to culture from within as partners and participants in a common project. This, too, is a major theme of the Holy Father's visit, one that will come into focus with two special events on Sunday evening in Venice after an open-air Mass in the morning. They are a meeting with representatives of culture, politics, commerce, and industry, and then the inauguration of the newly completed library at the Studium Generale Marcianum, the Venice Patriarchate's recently created center of learning and culture that aims at preserving and furthering the Church's vision of true wisdom as knowledge informed by charity. With the Holy Father in northeastern Italy, I'm Chris Altieri.
Later on Saturday evening, the Pope is scheduled to travel by helicopter to the lagoon city of Venice, a World Heritage Site visited by over 20 million tourists each year. The Pope spends Saturday night there at the Patriarchate, following a brief visit to the great Basilica of St. Mark for a moment of private prayer and veneration of the relics of the Evangelist. On Sunday, he celebrates Mass with the Patriarch, Cardinal Angelo Scola, at Mestre on the mainland, before returning by boat to the Basilica and a meeting with bishops from that northeastern region. He then travels by gondola along the canals to the Basilica della Salute, where he will meet with representatives from the world of culture and business. Among those addressing the Pope there will be Monsignor Brian Firm, rector of the so-called Studium Generale Marcianum, a new academic and research centre named after St. Mark the Evangelist, patron saint of the city. Monsignor Firm talked to Chris Altieri about the vision and the goals of this prestigious institute.
Yes, the Studium Generale Marcianum was established just over 7 years ago by the Patriarch of Venice, Cardinal Scola. It offers a whole series of various courses. There's the Faculty of Canon Law. There's the Institute of Theological Studies. Then we have various other programs. We have a higher school of research into economics, theology, and politics and their interaction. We have various international authorities come to give talks. We have summer schools in this area. We also have a master's degree, offer a master's degree in ethics and management of small industries, especially directed to the Veneto region. We have specialities in cultural study, especially in art and cultural activities connected, obviously, with Venice, and also specialized studies in bioethics. Why Studium Generale Marcianum? The phrase Studium Generale, or general studium, is, of course, at the origins of the university. Before universities were known actually as universities, they were known as Studia Generalia. And the choice of the name is specific because our idea at the Studium Generale is based on the concept, two concepts. One is the rapidly changing society in which we live and how educational, Catholic educational institutions can meet that. And secondly, on the reality that seems to us fairly obvious in modern, especially Western society, of the fragmentation of knowledge. And that this has caused, this rapid development and the fragmentation of knowledge, has caused a particular problem with respect to the individual. That is, their understanding of truth and their understanding of knowledge. And so what we aim to do here is to concentrate on the unity of knowledge, which was rather typical of the original medieval universities, the unity of knowledge, there's various branches, various disciplines of knowledge, in order that the individual will also have a unity within himself or herself. In a certain sense, I like to think of the Marcianum as the Catholic educational response in a unique and particular way to the whole question that has been put forward by the present pontiff, the relationship between faith and reason. And this is a new approach, a new possibility to that challenge of how to react and understand the profound relationship between faith and reason and how to do it in an educational, Catholic educational formative experience.
A new approach, but one that is quite clearly rooted in some very old ideas. How concretely are you adapting this educational vision to the exigencies of of the contemporary world?
I think there are two or three things that we do. One is size. It's not our intention ever to be a massive university, which in my opinion is one of the problems with modern university education, that they've become far too large. What does that mean? That physically and structurally and also personally, and by personal I mean the ability to actually physically meet and talk with other people, becomes terribly difficult for students and indeed professors to talk with students or professors from other faculty, from other schools and other faculties, other disciplines. So structurally, our size is always going to be limited, even though we have over 1,000 students, one way or another, coming through the studium every day. Secondly, this permits students to literally live in community with other disciplines, not only with other people, but other people from other disciplines, and discuss them, either at table or just generally between classes and so on. So that's an important thing. A third unique aspect of this unity of the person, the education year, is that the Marcianum, the Studium Generale Marcianum, stretches from infancy as students through the secondary school education to university and research, and that all of them feel part of the same institution. So that this break, for instance, which you often see between secondary school and then going to university, as if university was something completely and utterly new, is somehow, we hope, and slowly, overcome. And for instance, especially this occurs, especially with the students here in Italy, in Venice, at the Liceo, the last two or three years of secondary school education, one of the practical advantages is that professors from the university can often teach courses or offer talks and so on to the students in the Liceo, and the school students can come to conferences where we have Nobel Prize winners, international scholars and so on, who come here and speak. So this last summer at our summer school, we had Professor Robbie George from the University of Princeton come and speak about philosophical, social questions and so on. This is an ongoing process. So this sense, this physical structural sense, in a real structural sense, of understanding and living and realizing that knowledge isn't fragmented and therefore the person isn't fragmented, faith and reason can live together and we can live that, is something I think that is quite unique at this moment.
You're built into the seminary here. You're right inside the structure. Are you primarily concentrating on forming clergy, or is there also an element of laity present?
We live in the same, physically, in the same enormous palace from the 17th century as the seminary. And obviously, the idea of the Patriarch from the beginning was a practical one. The palace is just far too large for the present needs of the seminary. And secondly, that the seminary also, even though quite separate, absolutely separate in terms of statutes, in terms of its own lifestyle, its own timetable, can profit from the activities that we offer. The seminarians attend some of the classes and so on. It depends on their particular ratio studiorum of the seminary. Lay people, we certainly are not in any way, shape or form exclusively directed to the formation of clergy. Well, that's certainly not the case. We are, as the words universitas, or Studium Generale, universitas, involving, obviously, a whole group of people. What does that mean in practice? We have a good number of clergy who come here, especially for canon law, but not only, also for other courses, and we have a vast number of lay people following various courses. What we aim to do in those is obviously to present the Catholic tradition in those particular disciplines. But the Catholic tradition can never be presented simply in some sense as being as if one were antiquarian. You know, it's fascinating looking at nice books and but never reading them. We want them to understand the tradition and in the process offer that understanding and not only offer, but because they've realised the richness of that tradition, to offer it to the society in which they live. And we do that at a structural level as well, in terms of conferences, inviting people, being, I think, very active in the Venetian life. There's another aspect of Venice that's unique. Historically, Venice has always been sui generis, both politically and in terms of its relationship with the rest of Italy and indeed the rest of Europe. Indeed, it was a republic until the late 18th century, virtually, you know, 1790s. So Venice has always had a very unique historical approach to the whole question of relationship with other countries, which are much larger than it ever was, but also had an enormous advantage of being open to the East. And by the East, not just Greece and Turkey, which are a short distance away, but as far as China, one thinks of Marco Polo. This vocation of Venice to be open to the East is something that continues to this day, and it's still obviously tangible. It's tangible in Venice in its architecture. One only has to go into St. Mark's Basilica to see the influence of Byzantium on the mosaics and the whole structure, architecture of the basilica. But Venetians, my impression after 4 years here, is that Venice still holds dearly to this rather unique vocation. And so that offers the Marcianum a particular aspect, because one of the other areas in the Marcianum established by the patriarch and dear to him is the Center Oasis, which is a center that's been going for 7 or 8 years now, dedicated to Islamic, Christian, Catholic relations, especially the question of Catholics and Christians, minorities in predominantly Islamic countries. We have conferences every year. This year it would be at Venice. Last year it was in Jordan, I think, either in the Middle East. The conference is made up of many bishops who work in these countries, in Pakistan, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and so on. And this also builds into the whole question of this openness to the world.
Monsignor Brian Firm is rector of the Studium Generale Marcianum in Venice, the city Pope Benedict visits on Sunday. At just 41 years old, he's one of the youngest church leaders anywhere in the world. In March this year, Sviatoslav Shevchuk was elected as Major Archbishop of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, the largest Eastern Rite Church in full communion with the Holy See. During decades of persecution under repressive Soviet rule, the church spread throughout the diaspora, especially across Europe and North and South America. But today it's flourishing in its homeland again, especially in western Ukraine. Less than a month after his election by the Ukrainian Church Synod, Archbishop Shevchuk travelled to Rome to meet with Pope Benedict, and he was back here again recently for further discussions about the difficult question of reconciliation with the majority Orthodox churches in his country.
The major challenge of the situation of Ukraine is the division among the Orthodox, and this is quite it's quite difficult to create some relationships, because if we would develop our collaboration with one group among them, so two others can feel themselves ignored or
left out.
It's why, for us, it's very important that in Ukraine exists a special organization we would call the Ukrainian Council of the Churches and the Religious Organization. And each religious community which was registered by the state joined this council. And it creates some sort of possibility to collaborate, to speak at least, and to meet together with the state authorities and develop our internal relationships.
So a forum for collaboration,
yes,
amongst,
yes,
the different,
yes,
groups. What kind of reaction have you had from the different groups since your election?
Until now, positive reactions. First of all, for me, it was a big gift of God that in day of my enthronement, all representatives from the old churches came. The bishop from the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, bishop and the head of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of Kiev Patriarchate, and also a bishop from the Ukrainian Autocephalic Church. So the first time in the recent Ukrainian history that all those Orthodox, which are divided among them, they would never meet each other in the different places.
See?
But they join this same celebration that for our church was so important.
So you've already had a chance to put into practice this pledge for unity that is your,
yes,
top,
yes,
priority.
So our church has a special task to be a bridge between divided communities, not only between Catholics and non-Catholics, but even in, just like in this case, between the Orthodox, no? Create this space where they can meet not only us, but also each other.
You've said you want to meet with Patriarch Kirill in Moscow to try and push ahead with this reconciliation between the Orthodox groups, but also between Catholics and Orthodox. Have you had any reaction? How likely is this, do you think?
So I did manifest my openness, but until now I didn't receive any response. Recently, Patriarch Kirill visited Ukraine, commemorating 25th anniversary of the Chernobyl tragedy. But he didn't make any sign or willingness to meet our representative or somebody from our church. So, but we are still open.
So you're still waiting. Are you in contact with his representative, Metropolitan Vladimir? Have you had contacts with him?
Personally, not yet. Maybe after, when I'll be back in Ukraine in a few days, we'll organize our meeting. So he invited me to visit him, and I will try to organize those visits. And I hope that we can not only speak, but also collaborate.
Is there much collaboration at the moment in practical terms at all between the different groups?
Not quite big. Not really.
You talk about the need for purification of memory, for forgiveness as the first essential steps on this road.
Absolutely.
To reconciliation. That's a much easier thing for you, such a young man, to talk about, isn't it? You were barely out of your teens at the end of the Soviet regime, weren't you? Whereas others suffered under the Soviet system for decades.
Yeah, it's true, but I was 20 years old when the communism failed, and I do remember very well this tension between Orthodox and Greek Catholics in the Western Ukraine, which, thanks be to God, now does not exist anymore. And I do know very well those wounds that our people still bearing from that time in their memory. It's why I'm speaking not only in my own name, but also in the name of those communities which were wounded on that time. And also I do understand this, how I can say, not only fear, but this pain of the Orthodox community, or Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, which all the time claims that Greek Catholics destroyed their three eparchies in the Western Ukraine. So it's not easy question. But I think, first of all, just to be able to touch this issue, we have to be open and ready to forgive each other.
Do you have any practical ideas, any plans as to how you're going to be able to push ahead with this project of reconciliation?
Yeah. First of all, we are collecting specific information about those churches which Orthodox can claim, and how many communities do they have now in the Western Ukraine? How kind of relationships do we have among our communities in the very basic local level, and so that we can have clear statistics about what kind of churches we supposed to be asking, no, in the future. So we are making our own investigation. Then we can study or talk about the real situation, not fantastical numbers, but the real situation, and where, in which village perhaps do exist some sort of tensions. So only after we can be well prepared to meet Orthodox and just discuss about concrete churches, a concrete issue.
Pope John Paul II visited Ukraine, didn't he, in 2001. First of all, I'm wondering if you yourself have some particularly strong memories of that trip.
Yes, of course, because on that time I was a vice rector of the Lviv Holy Spirit Seminary, and our seminary was preparing this visit. And I was in charge of the liturgical part of that visit, and I was helping during the liturgy to the Holy Father and our bishops.
So a big responsibility.
Great responsibility. And also I was preparing the congregation to meet a pope when he was entering to this place to take part in our liturgy. So it was very emotional, because we gathered most than 1 million persons for the Greek Catholic liturgy on that day.
What do you think is the legacy that he left behind there in your country?
First of all, he destroyed some prejudices about the Pope himself, Catholic Church, and also he showed the kindness and authenticity of the evangelical proclamation, evangelical mission of the Church. And, you know, those personal contacts are well remembered until now.
His great desire was to see an end to the schism, wasn't it? He really wanted these two lungs, the East and West, to be able to breathe together again, as he put it so eloquently. And yet he wasn't able to do that. What kind of hope do you think there is now on a broader level about the possibility of reconciliation?
I would say that the hope always exists. Now, perhaps the Ukrainian society knows much more about Catholic Church, even about the Greek Catholics, than it was 10 years ago. Because a lot of Ukrainians still live with those categories left by the Soviet propaganda. And on that time, the Catholic Church, even the person of Pope, was presented like an enemy of the Ukrainian people. And step by step, Ukrainian society discovered that there is not an enemy, but a big authority, moral authority, not even for the Catholics, but for all citizens of Ukraine.
My thanks there to Sviatoslav Shevchuk, Major Archbishop of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Don't forget, you can find all our news and feature programmes, plus details of Pope Benedict's pastoral visit to Aquileia and Venice, on our website, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio, Laudato Jesus Christus.